Do you have a, pen by chance?
Yep.
I left my
briefcase. Here you go.
Thank you.
All right, I call to order the Wednesday, October 11th, 2017 Board of Ethics meeting. It is 6:35 p.m. We are meeting at the Tacoma Municipal Building at 733 Market Street, conference room number 12. Let's go ahead and start off with staff introductions. And I also would like, since we have a new member, if we could all kind of go around the room too after staff introduces themselves, tell us each a little bit about ourselves and our background so we all know each other a little better. And I know we haven't seen each other in a little while, so for a refresher for the rest of us. So can you start with staff introductions?
Sure. I'm Martha Lance. I'm the assigned attorney from the city attorney's office to the Board of Ethics.
And my name is Doris Sorm, and I'm the city clerk for the city of Tacoma as well as the liaison for the Board of Ethics.
Phil Sims, I'm vice chair.
And I'm Joe Atkinson. Or are you going to keep going, Bill, or are you not?
I'll just introduce, and then later we can talk and give a background, I guess.
Sure. And I'm Joe Atkinson. I am the chair.
Ohad Lowy, board member.
Linda Batway, board member.
Katie Bear, new board member.
All right. And then before we get into our regular business, we'll do the thorough introductions. And I'll start, I guess. So I am Joe Atkinson. My background is working in constituent services and policy and working at the legislature. I did about 6 years working for members down in Olympia and then about a year in the King County Council. So currently I run a business with my wife and I do real estate investment and work as a mostly commercial real estate broker. And I have three kids and I chair the Ruston Point Defiance Business District. I'm really involved with the cross-district Experience Tacoma, which tries to, you know, improve small business. We're really focused on a really unique and narrow model of small mom-and-pop businesses. So we never did include Point Ruston, but we do work with them a lot on stuff. And then I'm also working as a board member on the multi-service center in Federal Way. And that's basically my resume there. So go ahead, Ohad.
Sure. Ohad Lowy, resident of Tacoma. I work as an attorney for the Attorney General's office for the last 13 or 14 years. I now work for the Labor and Personnel Division, where I represent state agencies in employment matters, union matters, arbitrations, and also do a little immigration work for the state agencies.
I'm Linda Batway. I'm retired. I was a hospital social work director for most of my career, and I was at Harrison and Bremerton for many years and helped start the medical ethics committee there and served on it for about 10 years, but until I retired.
Go ahead, Katie. Or Bill, go ahead. You go ahead, and we'll let Katie go last.
Let Katie go last. So, Bill Sims. Been in Tacoma as a resident 45 years. I was here a couple years before that. At PLU, but then finished up at Eastern. Shame on me. Anyway, so I was with Boeing for 32 years. The last 15 of those years was teaching full-time and was involved in ethics and leadership development, personal development kinds of classes, some of which I wrote myself and stuff. Been retired for the last 6, plenty busy. So I have 3 kids, 6 grandkids. My latest just got married in June, so we're expecting him to populate us some more. We're hoping.
More than 6, that would be very busy. So,
where did you teach, Bill?
At Boeing.
Oh.
Yeah, I taught at Boeing for 15 years, full time.
So I'm Katie Beard. I've lived in Tacoma for almost 20 years. I've been teaching at UW-Tacoma. I teach classes in economics and public policy, and I've got my husband's an attorney in town, and we have 2 kids. Well, they're not kids anymore. They're out of the house. Both of them are flown the nest. So.
All right, thank you all. So moving on to business, and before we get into that, I just wanted to mention too, you know, we have a light agenda. We don't have a lot of items, but it's good to get face-to-face. And I want to let all the other members know, too, that this is an equal board. You know, I'm the one chairing the meetings, of course. But if we want to get other topics on our agendas and move anything forward, please feel free to contact our great staff, too, because, you know, if we have other issues that we can work on, we're all hard workers and we're ready to work on things. But just moving on, we are going to have a quick discussion about our administrative procedures. I think...
did you hand out copies?
Yes. Oh, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh, I made, because I made copies.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Okay. Yeah, this is something that Joe and Doris and I discussed might be a good idea to cover for a couple of reasons. One is having a new member, and I just want to let everybody know that I know Katie. We served together on the Pierce County Charter Review Commission a year and a half ago, so we spent every Wednesday night together for 6 months. But because of that, Doris suggested that we might want to give Katie the open meetings and public records training, and I said, yeah, she's already got that. So we were trained in that regard. And also, you served on a prior city board commission, right? I think that...
long time I was on the tap,
yes, but I remember I remember giving the presentation or the training to that group too.
Oh,
so
okay.
We're happy to give you a refresher on open records and open meetings anytime you want. But
okay.
I didn't want to bring the whole show to the rest of the group again. They've heard it at least twice. Yeah. That said. What we thought it would be helpful, both for the new member and for everyone, is to go over the administrative procedures of the board, which are essentially like the bylaws or the procedure documents that govern the board's work in addition to the code of ethics. And we had a complaint that was dealt with over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. And the complaint was against a council member, and it had a lot of allegations in it. And what we ended up doing was dismissing it according to the code and the administrative procedures without having a board meeting and without doing anything that might feel like adjudicating the complaint, like, you know, didn't summon any witnesses or, you know, question the council member or anything like that. And that was... the way that the process works according to both the code and the procedures. But I know that in talking about it with Joe and with some of the others of you, there was, I don't want to say confusion, but maybe just a little feeling of that seemed like, you know, maybe it wasn't the right approach or didn't seem consistent with what feels to be the charge of the board. So, again, talking with the chair, we thought it would be good to sort of go over the administrative procedures and see where they where they're relating to the code. And then if people have questions as we go along, or if it doesn't make sense, or you know, if it doesn't seem consistent with you know, how business ought to be done, we can absolutely talk about that. I don't want to cover every last bit of it, but I think the complaint process and how complaints are dealt with might be helpful. And I can give a little history too, because these were rewritten in 2012, which doesn't seem that long ago. But
I know it is.
I
know.
Procedures.
Yeah. So it was a completely different board composition at the time. But the history, particularly around the complaint processing, that these procedures were brought into place, was because that board at the time was getting like couple complaints a week. I mean, it was for a while, they were being filed by people that didn't take any time or effort to really, you know, put forward an actual allegation. We had 4 or 5 of them in a row that forwarded a newspaper article and said, you know, here's the facts, you know, adjudicate it, do something about it.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any procedures at the time that allowed the board to do anything other than meet in person, you know, arguably hear from the person who filed the complaint, maybe have the person who was complained against come in. And the board at the time determined that that really wasn't productive, especially for the types of complaints that were being filed, because the complaining people weren't shouldering any of the burden. They were just saying, you know, throwing something out there, and then it all came back to the board to ferret it out and to figure out if there was anything there. And in nearly all of the cases, there wasn't anything there. In one or two of them, there was, and then in that case, the board said, well, there's been enough here that it's sort of tipped the scales that our job to investigate and to meet and to do something has been triggered, so we will, and we did. And then in both of those cases, went quite a bit further and actually gathered evidence, used some various tools that took a deposition one time. Somebody came and gave testimony.
Can you give us an overview of what all we are able to do in a very serious case?
Yeah, sure. So that's kind of what I was getting at, is you do have all kinds of ways that if you get over the hurdle of the complaint actually, you know, presenting something that needs further analysis, you have a lot of options. And not all of them are super resource intensive, and that, again, is something that came up when we redid these procedures, because prior to that, really the only way that you could get at facts was to call somebody in and hold a hearing, or to, you know, hire an investigator to go out and do the, you know, get documents and do witness interviews and things like that. So what these procedures allow is various ways of obtaining evidence. Can send written questions to witnesses, can, like I said, take a deposition, you can have people come in and testify before the board, yeah.
So, like, the deposition or testimony, is that something then that you, as our attorney, would do the deposition, or is it the board members asking the questions?
The board members ask the questions.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it was supposed to be live testimony, but it wasn't. I don't know. Somehow it turned into a deposition. It was...
I was out.
exactly as planned. And in that case, actually, the chair of the board was also an attorney. So he did the questioning, and then other board members who were there were able to ask their own questions as well. So I'm calling it a deposition. It wasn't really a very great deposition. But all of that is to say is that there were all kinds of mechanisms that we had to obtain evidence that allowed the board... In those cases, to take the next steps and say, okay, now we've got more facts. We have some facts that were given under oath. You know, we've investigated some of the allegations in this complaint and done it this way. We've sent written questions. That's been pretty effective.
Yeah.
Just ask to have people return the answers with signing that they'd done it under oath. Can go out and get more documents if things are public in the public record. We've asked. The board has asked staff to go and find things like, you know, prior legislation of the council and resolutions and things like that would be available regardless. So anyway, that's kind of the backstory on how we got to these procedures. So the process for a complaint under our current procedures and under the code is that a complaint can be made by anyone. And, you know, of course, the board only has jurisdiction over certain types of complaints. If it's an ethics complaint about somebody who's not, the code calls it a covered official, just a regular city employee, then that doesn't come to this body. Those are heard by either ultimately the utilities director or the city manager, but they're usually delegated for investigations. But so you have covered officials, which are the elected officials, the city manager and the utilities director themselves, under the theory that we don't want them investigating themselves, and also in covered officials includes other members of other boards and commissions. So there was once a complaint against a member of the Landmarks Preservation Commission.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually the one where the goofy deposition came out, because the board wanted to talk to, it had to do with a school construction and an alleged conflict of interest. And the board wanted to talk to the contracts officer, the procurement officer for the school district. And somehow the school district's attorney, we wanted to do just written questions, but the school district's attorney said, no, he won't answer the written questions under oath, but I'll bring him down and you can take his deposition. So that's, it was peculiar. So
I prefer written questions.
I know, so that's how that turned out. What arose out of, all of that history was to really kind of lay out a complaint process, which is what we have now, that would allow the board to not have to implicate resources every single time, and to put some burden on the person filing the complaint to do more than just throw stuff out there.
A piece of newspaper article.
Yeah. So on the complaint process is on page 3 of the administrative procedures. And this is how it works, is that if we get a complaint, then the board, and that would be Doris, sends written confirmation of receipt of the complaint to the complaining person. Then they give a copy of the complaint to the person against whom the complaint was filed. So if it's a council member, they get a copy. And to the city attorney, but not to the legal advisor city attorney, the actual city attorney. And then section 3 and section 2.3 is the initial process, which is where the assigned city attorney makes an initial review for legal sufficiency of the complaints received. And legal sufficiency is to determine where a complaint alleges facts, which even if they're true, so that for the purposes of the sufficiency review, we would assume that the allegations are true, that the facts stated are true. But even if they're true, they wouldn't constitute a violation of the Code of Ethics.
Now, was that added in after 2012? Or was that only added in, or was the whole thing changed?
Yeah, no, I could compare word for word to what it was before, but that was an extra step, is this legal sufficiency review that wasn't there before. And again, the purpose of that was to not implicate a bunch of resources and make everyone come in and have a meeting if there really wasn't anything there. So, because, like I said, we had probably 6 meetings in a row where they come and you look at the stuff and say, well, okay, this alleges this, or this newspaper article says this, or this person says this. Let's assume that every bit of it is true. Is there any kind of violation here? No, we're done. And, determined that probably wasn't the best use of resources. So added this initial step where the attorney would do the legal sufficiency review. And if there was a determination by the attorney that all of the facts, and the one that we just did had hundreds, dozens,
if not thousands.
If not thousands of facts alleged.
And then the board reviews that legal sufficiency argument and makes a decision whether or not we actually meet. And then we do a simple majority vote, basically.
Mm-hmm. And the piece that was also added in addition to that legal sufficiency type of review, was to specifically say that once that had been done, that the board's attorney could communicate that by email. And all the board members would get the email, and it would contain the opinion of the deputy city attorney that there was legal sufficiency. Well, I mean, it would contain the opinion that there wasn't legal sufficiency. If there was, then I would say, we need to have a meeting. And allow the board members to review the opinion of the city attorney, and then allows the board members to vote by email. And that's allowed because even though you're bound by the Public Meeting Act, which normally doesn't allow things to be done by email or without the public present, there is an exception if you're acting as an adjudicating board, and you're hearing a case that involves, an allegation against a particular person. It says matters between named parties. So for that reason, it would be all right to have your deliberations by email. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quickly, and I don't know if you're going to cover this, but so let's say we get a complaint, and it comes in, we investigate it, we issue a finding. What happens then? Do we have any power? Does it go to the council who is there a sanction after we make who makes that determination of what happens with our findings?
Ultimately, the council makes the determination, but we would write up findings and conclusions, and you can have a recommended disposition. So if it's a council member, only they can discipline themselves. Mm-hmm. If it's another type of covered official, if it's a member of some other board or commission, I think, you know, this body would be able to say, we admonish, or we, I mean, it's in the code what your options are. You couldn't actually remove somebody from their board or commission because the council would have appointed them, so that only they could unappoint. But, to answer your question, it depends on who the complaint
sure.
is against.
Yeah,
but either way, I guess it's
spelled out too.
Is it? Did I not?
Where's that at? Doors?
I think that's in the code itself.
Oh, it's in,
okay, it's in the actual. Yeah.
But really, though, that we may have recommendations and findings, but what is done with that?
Mm-hmm.
No matter what, sounds like it could be a different body will determine.
Right.
I have your findings.
Well, it's not super clear, but the way that we've done it and the way that it seems to make sense is that. The findings and conclusions are what they are. This
right.
body can reach them. I mean, the council can do what they want if they wanted to say, we don't like your little order, and they tore it up. I mean, they could do that. But typically the findings and conclusions are in the authority of this board. They're written up, and then if there's something that they're presented to the council, and if it's a council member, actual code. If it's a council member, they're supposed to then do what, you know, if they want to accept the recommendation, they're supposed to give the admonition or the reprimand or the, you know, or whatever to their colleague.
Mm-hmm.
When we recommended that in at least one case, I don't think they ever got around to it.
That's what I was going to ask. Do they have to have a hearing on our recommendations?
No. But we've not had an instance where the council has said, well, we didn't like what, you know, the findings or the conclusions. Well, they may not have, but they didn't. There's no authority for them to redo it. There's not like a de novo hearing or anything like that. So,
and can a person appeal or find the board's findings or?
That's in the code.
I know. I'm gonna.
Sorry,
I
didn't mean to ask. Too many.
I have a printing it out.
Oh, this is very helpful. Yeah. Sorry, I just was.
I know that she's printing out some now.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
So we can go over that because
okay.
I think that's helpful too. As soon as we get it.
Yeah, because I guess I was just trying to figure out the bounds of our authority and power, for lack of a better word.
So going back to the legal sufficiency, that is what we did in this complaint that we had before, and. What I did in that case was to go ahead and write up an order because it was so long and it was really an efficiency thing. Normally I would write an opinion and say, you know, I don't think there's any facts here. I recommend that we do an order. But in this particular case, I went right ahead and did the order for your consideration because I didn't want to do it twice because it was so long. I thought if I was going to the trouble to write the opinion on all these points, that I might as well just do the order. But however it's presented, In the email voting, the board members then can get to look at it, and if they disagree with the opinion, you would so state, and then it's still, like Joe was saying, it's a majority. So, you know, if a majority says, yeah, we think that this is appropriate for dismissal, we agree with the attorney's opinion, then it would be dismissed. But there's always the opportunity to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
It's just done by a majority. So
we could say we don't agree or disagree. We're undecided. So our vote is that we need to meet and discuss it. We don't need to make a decision right there.
Well, what we say in the procedures is after consideration of the complaint, along with the city attorney's opinion, a concurrence of a majority of a quorum of the board. So, you know, a majority
so two
of
two people.
Yeah, exactly. However, it has to be at least three.
Three
many?
People. Three people.
Well, the quorum
was three before.
A concurrent
is three, so
yeah,
majority.
Yeah,
is
a concurrent.
Four.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
yep.
So it has to be at least three to participate, and two
and
out of three.
Two
would,
out of yeah.
Yeah. Would be required for a dismissal. So we don't really say whether we could say that. Well, we don't really have an opinion, but we'd like to meet. I mean, certainly, if a majority of the board said that, you could call a meeting.
Well, you would just have to say I disagree if
yeah.
you wanted
yeah.
to have a meeting.
But if you didn't, that's how I would say to, I would set that up as if, you know, even if you thought that dismissal was probably appropriate, but you didn't want to vote for it, that's what you would do. And then if there was a majority that felt that way, then you would have a meeting and go down to the next steps, which would be to meet and determine next steps, which would consist of, you know, is there more to investigate, or, you know, do we want to have a discussion on with what we've got? In a couple of cases, maybe, I think possibly with this board, or some of this group, we did not do the review by email. We just had the review take place in a meeting, and that was because we had a meeting scheduled, and we got a complaint, like, the day before. So that might have been a little bit confusing, maybe, that we didn't exercise the email process in that instance, rather we just gathered and made the decision there. So, I mean, it's, you know, these procedures are to use resources properly to relieve you all from, you know, meeting unnecessarily, as well as to put some sort of sideboards, I guess, out there that the people who file the complaints have some duty to present something that, you know, if considered true, would establish some sort of violation. It's not enough just to, like, list off bad things that they think happened. They actually have to be bad things that are, you know, that if they really did happen are within your jurisdiction and constitute a violation of the code.
We actually take those bad things to interpret them as all being true, and if they were true, do they violate the ethics code? And if they were true and they violated it, then we have an obligation. But that's kind of how we take the questions. You know, we'll take every allegation and say, okay, this is true, let's assume that it's true, and how does it violate the ethics code? So,
right.
And the last case, of course, wasn't a case where they threw a newspaper article. They submitted a lot of documents. So,
but
and the issue with me was that the legal sufficiency review took a while to come, and just so much time went by. I would have liked to have a more timely response to the complaint. And then I was going to ask, so we do not have to have the legal review before we meet. We could meet and then discuss that at the meeting, or could we meet and say, well, let's discuss the allegations and then get the legal sufficiency review on a particular case?
You could. I mean, like I said, the point of putting that legal sufficiency review step in there was to add efficiency. So, I mean, at that point, you probably wouldn't need to retreat and get a written opinion
because
you were already
would we meet to discuss it and then get an opinion? Because if the opinion is there's no legal sufficiency, why did we waste?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to say that part of, and maybe because I come out of a medical ethics, where part of the whole value of the process is to get different thoughts of folks. And I appreciated how much work you did on that. I really found it really valuable. But it seemed like there was so much complexity in it that some opportunity for the board to talk about it would have been valuable in terms of you know, feeling like we met the obligation to hear a case, that whether we found it fully or not, people put a lot of time and effort into submitting. You put a lot of time and effort into it, and I just felt like we should have some opportunity to understand and talk about some of the thinking process as you went through it. That was my opinion.
And my question is can we communicate those types of thoughts without having a public meeting? Can she give you that opinion and say, share this thought or opinion with the other members, and you guys get that to us, and then some other people may have changed their vote and wanted to meet possibly. And
well, I don't want to get too far. Though, like I said, it's an adjudicative process sort of outside of the Open Meeting Act, I don't want to get, I think that's kind of a slippery slope to start, you know, opening up.
Well, it seems to me discussions are for exchange of information,
right.
And when you do it over email,
right,
at distances, you often lose the value of gathering each other's thoughts about things.
Go ahead.
That's okay. I don't want to waste people's time by any means, but it seems to me if it's important for us to feel as a combined unit that we're working in some direction, it would be helpful.
I mean, I think part of my problem with the last complaint, I don't know, you probably have, I mean, for me, there's a difference between facts and conclusions, because that complaint seemed to have a lot of conclusions. Mm-hmm. And for me, at least the way I've seen other courts who kind of review stuff, conclusions are not facts. So just because you said X did, you know, I'm trying to think of a hypothetical. I mean, but conclusions aren't facts. So, I mean, right now there's a requirement, like a gatekeeper requirement, and if they don't make it through the gate, why waste all our time discussing it? I mean, they have a certain obligation to meet. Now, if we don't like the gate criteria, we probably could change it. But they have an obligation to provide enough facts to get through the gate. And if they don't, I guess that's why we can disagree. When we get a thing to vote on, we can disagree and say, no, we do think there are enough facts, or maybe. But to just kind of meet and talk about stuff that doesn't even rise to the level of a complaint, I'd rather be doing other stuff, I guess.
Well, one of my concerns is, in terms of their obligations, is that a lot of average citizens, if they're going to feel like they have access to making a complaint, they don't necessarily have huge resources to do that kind of investigative work. So I think we have to encourage them to give us as much as they can, but we also have to be open to making it accessible to them and to take seriously what they're offering and further look at it.
Well, the complaint form does tell people that they need to provide us with facts and as much evidence as they have. Mm-hmm. And we say in the administrative procedures here that a complaint shall state the basic facts surrounding the alleged violation, including the nature of the violation, date, time, place, name of the persons responsible, and any documentation or other evidence that the complainant can produce regarding the alleged violation, including the name, address, and telephone number of each person having knowledge of the violation alleged. The complaint should also state or reference the specific provision or provisions of the Code of Ethics alleged to be violated. So that, again, was part of the revamp of these procedures, was to put, like Ohad was saying, to put some responsibility on the claimant to actually put something forward mm-hmm. that, you know, wasn't just a fishing expedition, both for the issue of, you know, the guarding of the resources of this body, but also to protect the covered officials. Because if you just throw something out there and everything is given the same credence and the same, you know, investigation, there's nothing to stop people from just, you know, opening up fishing expeditions. So that was the thinking behind it. But I will say that two things. One, Joe, is I definitely apologize for the length of time it took to work through that. I mean,
but I understand.
There was a lot there. And then once I started down the road of saying, well, there's a lot here, but I don't think there's really anything here, I wanted to take the time to like write it up in a way that was valuable to you, and that took me longer than I thought. So, you know, I definitely should have, it would have been better, I think, for Doris and I to get in touch with you guys along the way and say this is what we're doing. So I apologize for that.
Yeah, and it was written up in a very good way that was understandable to the complaining party as well. Mm-hmm. I'm very sure. So,
and I think part of the problem, I don't think it's the complaint process that's necessary, the difficult one to understand. I think it's the prohibited conduct mm-hmm. that's hard to understand. I think maybe that's where I don't know if there's a way to give a simplified guide to. Because that's the thing, right? People come and say, this person did this and did that and that. Well, the ethics part of what we review is pretty narrow. And if it doesn't fall under these four, you know, a couple of things, which even for me, I had to read like four or five times to kind of understand. So maybe it's more helpful to provide kind of a more non-legalese version of what is allowed and not allowed. Because that's where I think people get, that's where really to trip up on, right? It's because they're putting all this stuff, but none of them. It's not that they're not filing the right thing or they're not, but they're alleging things that are not, that are not an ethics violation.
Right. This seems like it must be a problem.
We kind of floated this document around several months ago, and I don't know if that's something that could be worked on to get better information to folks, but just kind of stepping back to my issue is that I don't want this board to be used as a platform to complain about disagreements on political issues.
Right. And that, I mean, you're absolutely right, Joe. Some of the thinking was to really to strike a balance between, you know, giving people, citizens an opportunity and a forum to, you know, to ask for enforcement of these the provisions of the code, but not to make it such that, you know, you could just.
I didn't like what you said.
Yeah, exactly. Or a political or a personal. I mean, we've seen a few of those over the course.
Sure.
So I think another thing that this was sort of an odd. It was just different than what we usually get. Is usually the complaints don't have so much in them, and they're a little more simple. So what we've done in the past that I think might have given you more comfort and opportunity for discussion, Linda, or not just you, but in general, is the legal opinion was pretty simple, saying there's three basic things that they're saying. Doesn't rise to the level, I recommend dismissal. And then, the complaint was short enough and simple enough that everybody had the same information, and you could say, yeah, that I agree. And then I would write up an order that would then be a second opportunity for discussion. And I think maybe putting it all into one step here, like, took maybe eliminated an opportunity to either meet if you wanted to, because what we've done in the past is at the stage that the order is circulated, so that if anybody wants to meet and talk about this, we can call a meeting. Otherwise, if you authorize us to sign it, or authorize the chair to sign it, then go ahead and indicate that. So again, this was an odd one. We could give it to you to read, Katie. it was a big complaint and a.
It'll be great if you have insomnia.
Yeah.
One thought I have is that some time ago, Joe and I started to meet to talk about trying to figure out how to do that, look at that request in the complaint and try to see if we could simplify it. And I'm thinking about actually having people have to check a box saying, mm-hmm. this is the complaint that I'm making, this is the part of the code.
Mm-hmm.
And then Joe went and had a baby, and we got off track of meeting, and we never got to do that. And so that might be something, too.
And we've looked at that in the past. We have had some constraints. I'm not saying that they're insurmountable, but they were presented to us as constraints in the past, is that the city had gone to this... the 311 thing that you can complain about all kinds of things, potholes, your elected officials, but they basically have one form for for anything. So they had told us at the time that you needed to check that it was a complaint under the code of ethics, but the process that they had to intake things didn't have too much room for it wasn't flexible.
There wasn't any flexibility. Yeah. So it was just, this is a board of ethics, and then you just wrote your...
Yeah.
But it was like, this is a neighborhood complaint. Their yard was a mess.
Mm-hmm.
This was an ethics complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all one form. And
that makes it challenging.
Mm-hmm. But it might have...
We might be able to revisit that.
We might be able to revisit that now. Yeah.
Or maybe they would allow like a sub, keep it, but can we put a sub in you? So if you click ethics,
then it goes on to like supplemental.
Yeah.
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 Supplemental.
Yeah, and like maybe links you to the code of ethics or even a checkbox thing that says it's.
Certainly medical ethics is a whole different world than this, but one of the things that we found was that when we got an ethics concern. And ours were like end of life issues kind of thing, so quite different. But what we did is we'd have a little. Ours was a much bigger board, but we'd have a subgroup of with a couple different disciplines. But we would then contact the person raising the issue and help them formulate. Just help them get the language and whatever we needed to see where it was going to fit in the ethics piece.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that has merit or not. I'm thinking the average citizen kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking along the same lines, anything we could do to get better, more clear information to people would be good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do they have a city staff member they could call if somebody has a complaint that that they could call and have a discussion with? And
Well, I mean, if somebody wants to call and chat, like, you know, the city attorney's office can talk to them, the clerk's office can talk to them. And, you know, I don't want to be too cynical here, but the time that Doris and I have been doing this, I have not seen, other than once or twice, a concerned citizen as the person who came forward. It was somebody with, you know, an agenda. And I'm not saying that that means that they don't have the right to address their government. Of course they do. But, you know, because the trend that, you know, that was another thing that went into these administrative procedures is the board at the time didn't want to create a forum that where, you know, somebody showed up and demanded to be heard, or, you know, that they felt that you know, the process was gave them an opportunity that wasn't there. I mean, the process, even in the code, not even interpreted by the procedures, the complaining party is not, I mean, they file the complaint, but they aren't a party to the action. I mean, they could be called as a witness by the board, but they don't have a built-in right to address the board.
Interesting.
Yeah, and we've done some minor things to get better information, like it used to link the entire Tacoma City Code. Now they can click and get just the ethics code. So anything we could do to get people more clear information.
Just
something to brainstorm for the future.
The thing that you guys were working on, was that like a little pamphlet? Or
you guys created that.
Oh, yeah, we have it.
Right. And then we were going to work.
They needed a work. It needed to be a simplified.
Yeah,
level.
Yeah, we were going to do
that. So that, I mean, that's not a bad idea at all, is to sort of try to, you know, drill down and capture in kind of plain speak what these prohibited conduct pieces are, because they're not super clear.
They aren't.
And I think the thing is that at its core, this code of ethics and most code of ethics for elected officials, municipal officers, state employees, I mean, it's really getting to financial conflicts of interest. It's really what it does. You know, as well as, you know, not using the resources of the government for your own benefit or gain. But it's really about pecuniary, that's the word in the city charter, pecuniary interests. So, but again, I think you're all right, but that's not super clear to, you know, people who are feeling aggrieved. You know, they feel like, well, I disagreed with him, or they did something that was, you know, that bothered me, and that must be unethical, it must be wrong. Well, actually, there's not, like, that many things.
But I think for a lot of folks, too, if the language, the legalese language, puts them off, then they don't do it. And, you know, I just don't want to create the illusion of, or the reality of, keeping people who might have a very legitimate concern from raising it because the process seems mind-boggling.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Although, you know, again, it has no bearing on it, but the people who filed the complaint that we just heard, they knew exactly what they were doing.
And I am fine with 2.33 on the complaint process, the legal sufficiency review. I'm fine with the language. I mean, the only thing just floating at an idea that may improve it would be to make it have to be unanimous. So if there was a board member that felt like the process wasn't going right, then we all would have to meet. That would be the only change. But to do such a change, we'd have to go through an entire process with the city council and have them change it. And I don't know if that's worth it, considering that it is on us if we think it's important to meet on any particular case. And that's just our responsibility.
Well, you can change, in this case, you can change your procedures amongst yourselves. It's only what's in the code.
Okay.
So in the code itself, the complaint process is there's two complaint processes, but the one that concerns you is in the board for the Board of Ethics. It's 045. So
is it 04? Wait.
Well, that's the power and duties of the board. So
Oh, 040.
So you're saying the code allows us to make changes to our own administrative procedures.
Yes, that is correct. Okay. No, the complaint process for the Board of Ethics is in 045, but it's at the end. 040 is regular city employees. Regular people. So the complaint process for the Board of Ethics starts in section F of 045. It's on page 294 of the handout here. So tracks the administrative procedures track it, but give more detail. So the section 2 is what the administrative procedures were designed to sort of flesh out. Because what it said before was, or just the code, the board shall acknowledge receipt of the complaint, forward it to the person complained against and to the city attorney, and then promptly meet and review the complaint. So the legal sufficiency review without the meeting was to give the, you know, some flexibility that if there wasn't anything there, there was no need to meet and review the complaint. And then after giving due consideration to a complaint, which due consideration, if you look, is where the administrative procedures come in, that you've got this legal opinion and it's had a legal sufficiency review. After that, the board can dismiss the complaint, that it doesn't allege facts sufficient to constitute a violation, or it has no jurisdiction, or the complainant doesn't cooperate. if they need to cooperate, like, you know, if you ask them for more information and they don't do it, you could dismiss on those grounds. Or, and then this is the or, if you vote, if the legal sufficiency review, either I would say, I think there's something here, you should consider it further, or, you know, there's a majority that disagrees with my opinion that it should be dismissed, then you can either determine without any further investigation that the complaint alleges facts which considered as true would constitute a violation of the code, or that you need further information to determine if a violation of the code of ethics has occurred. And that's usually the case, I think. What we've seen is, you know, that okay, there's enough here that, you know, if we presume all of this is true, looks like there's a violation. But we haven't seen one that's been so cut and dry that the board was comfortable saying the next thing we're going to do is go ahead and issue an order. Pretty much every case, it's been, okay, let's get a few more facts just to sort of, you know, check this. And that's the ways of getting facts that I was talking about earlier. We've done it by written questions. They've had, you know, they've said you can come in, you know, we want you to come in and testify. Send us, asking the clerk or staff to gather more information that's in the public record. I want to see you know, the resolution, or what's this piece of legislation that they were talking about. So, if you need to establish a factual record in order to determine whether there's a code violation, you can either appoint an investigator or conduct an investigation of the fact. So conducting the investigation, again, can consist of all of those ways of gathering the additional evidence that you need to come to a conclusion. Or you could actually, you know, hold a hearing. You could act like a court. You could have people come in and testify under oath. And we haven't done that because we've never gotten to a case where that seemed like a good use of all of the resources, because what they've done instead is to gather facts in these other, you know, less resource-intensive ways. Mm-hmm. And then we're able to come to a conclusion because of that. You could hire an investigator to go out and do that, or you could use an investigator from the city. The investigator wouldn't, you know, convene the hearing, but the investigator would do witness interviews and come back with a report. In one case, very early on in my doing this,
we did that.
The board did hire an investigator, and that ended up being really costly. It cost like about $40,000 or $50,000 at the end of the day. So that was, again, one of the reasons that some of these other procedures and other options were put in, if not in the code directly, but in the administrative procedures to, you know, just so that wouldn't always be the case. So after, you know, you get all your findings, however you get them, or all your facts, however you get them, then, you know, if you've gotten past the stage where you either, you know, said there's a violation without any further investigation, or you dismissed it, if you did fact finding, then you can, you know, issue an order that says there's no violation, or make a preliminary finding that a violation of the code has occurred. And then this is sort of the due process piece, that if you find that you think that there's a violation, then you'd have to write up preliminary findings of facts and conclusions of law, and then the person who's complained against, they have the opportunity to come and contest it. So,
and how does that order look like? I mean, with that five board, like, is there like if there's like a, let's say it's a 3-2 vote. Mm-hmm. That there's an ethics violation. Is there like a dissent part? I mean, is it like a court of appeals mm-hmm. opinion? Or is it just
We put a dissent in once. Somebody wrote a dissent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I said, okay, I'll write that up for you. So it doesn't really say. Who did that? Was that Stan?
I think it was Stan.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all coming back to me now. Yeah. I said, okay, I'll write that.
And is there any reporting back to the original person who made the complaint?
Yes, at the end of the day, whatever happens to the complaint, whether it's dismissed, whether there's a finding, no matter what, it goes back out to the complaining party.
So the last one that you've been talking about, the person was told that mm-hmm. you determined mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. it was...
Mm-hmm. And I send it out in with a certified. I send it out in an email. I send it out certified.
And what did they get with that? Did they just get a brief statement saying that we've reviewed it, or did they?
No, they got the whole order.
They got your whole
yeah.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the event that you did do these preliminary findings and conclusions, then if the defendant, I guess it's not really the defendant, the person who's complained against, they can request a hearing. They have 10 days. And if they request a hearing before this board, that's their opportunity to present whatever testimony, evidence they want to have considered to mm-hmm. rebut the preliminary findings and conclusions. Mm-hmm. And then after that's all done, after you've heard any additional testimony, statements, evidence presented, you can either say, no, we're sticking with what we originally said, or you can, modify it.
In the preliminary findings and conclusions, that's mm-hmm. that criteria that if all these allegations are true, then yes, they do violate the code of the ethics. And then we're obligated as a group to investigate if those allegations are true.
No, actually, we're a step ahead of that. The first is if they're all true, then, we can either find a violation or gather further facts and then find a violation. But if you say that there is something here, all of the evidence that you've gathered, however you've done it, does establish a violation, then you'd write preliminary findings and conclusions, and it's at that point that the person
complained against.
Yes. I don't know why I want to call them defendant.
Object of the complaint.
Yes.
Yeah.
They then have the opportunity to make their case saying, you were wrong. Your preliminary conclusions are all wrong.
And in most cases, they want it to be done with. And I don't think we've had many people rebut, at least since I've been around.
No. We do, yeah.
They just
want to
get it over with and get it out of the newspapers or whatever. Yeah.
And I'm sorry if I missed it, but is there a statute of limitations on how far back you can file a complaint about?
No.
So when someone gets a dismissal, they can rewrite it and resubmit it if they think they can.
Well, it says in the code, a complaint dismissed under F2, which is that there's no jurisdiction or no facts, that even if true would constitute a violation. It's dismissed with prejudice, and a complaint dismissed by the board but it will not be reconsidered if resubmitted by the complainant unless they present new factual allegations. And if you dismiss it and they don't do anything new, it can't come back.
Oh.
So then, if you would make these preliminary findings and conclusions, there either is a request for a hearing from the person complained against, or there isn't. Their 10 days pass and they don't do anything. Then you make a final determination, and then those preliminary findings, or whatever, however you've modified them, become actual findings of fact and conclusions of law. And at that point, you include your recommended disposition, if you have one. And then those are forwarded to the complaining party and to the party complained against. A copy goes to the city attorney and to the city council for matters involving a city elected official, an appointed member of the public utilities board, or other city board or commission. or the city manager, or the and the or the city or,
utility director.
Okay. So if it's council members, appointed members of boards or commissions that the council appoints, or the director of utilities, or the city manager, those all go to the council. If it's somebody else that is under the, I don't know who else that would be.
And what about
Covered officials?
I know it. What, civil service board?
Oh yeah. Okay. Could be. Yeah. Yeah, not an appointed member, yeah.
Yeah, I read an old complaint about civil service board. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then that goes to the council, and the penalties for that can be recommended by the board are in 1.46050. So you can recommend, and the council or the public utility board can impose upon anybody found to have violated the provisions of the code a combination of the following penalties. So they could do it, but they could do a cease and desist order. Stop violating the code. An order to disclose any reports or other documents or information that have been requested and not have been forthcoming. So, like, I guess if you needed, you know, if you weren't getting your records that you'd asked for, that you could take that up. That itself would be a violation. They can discipline, including termination or removal from any position, paid or unpaid, excluding elected positions. So, members of boards and commissions could be removed, but the council can't remove each other. Only the voters can remove. Mm-hmm. But they can remove a member of a board or commission. And there's also admonition, reprimand, and censure. And those are things that have to be recommended. And then the council is supposed to do it. An admonition shall be a verbal statement approved by the city council and made to the individual, you know, by the council or by the mayor. And a reprimand is a same sort of deal. A censure is even worse.
Lots of shaking all your fingers.
Right. But like I said, those are things that this board can recommend, but it then goes up to the council and they either do it or they don't.
Because the censure is actually done in public.
Mm-hmm.
Stop.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
If a complaint comes and the party being complained against just says that they're guilty,
mm-hmm.
I did it, you know, sorry, I mistake, whatever, does it still have to come through us, or is that
I would think we'd want to write up a simple order in that case, just mm-hmm. to make the record and to move it along, but that's never happened.
Because
so.
No.
it would come to us, and then the person
right.
may decide to respond before we have a hearing about it and say, look, I made a mistake, it was inadvertent.
Right.
Then we would still be obligated to hear that statement and then make a recommendation on what, if it's a reprimand or any of the other possible punishments. So. And if it was inadvertent, then there's lower level things. And then, but yeah, the city council has authority over any kind of final decision. And but you said that they don't have to discuss it. Have they ever not discussed if the board made a decision to reprimand or do something else? Have they ever?
The only thing that the board has done is an admonition, and it was not done in public.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't say that it has to be. So. I don't know. They didn't put it on their agenda. Let's put
nope.
it that way. But it doesn't say that they have to. A censure, on the other hand, would have to go through some
okay.
public process. Yeah.
So, okay.
So then you were asking, Oed, about appeal rights. If the person objects to the action taken by the city council, they can ask the mayor for a review of the action taken, and then the whole council is supposed to look at it and can take whatever further action they think is appropriate. That's final and not subject to further review, except as otherwise provided by law. But we do say that, and this is 060 is where to seek review, but that's true for both complaints against city, regular city employees and the elected officials. If certain things happen, if a cease and desist order, the affected party can go for a writ to Pierce County Superior Court. We don't say how to do it or how much time you have or anything, so that becomes the court's problem, I guess. Same with disclosing documents, discipline or removal from office, and the person disciplined or removed can seek whatever remedies exist at law.
So I guess my question is, so while I've been on this board, I've had two complaints. Both of them did not make it through for legal sufficiency, but both of them were, at least from appearances, were not, you know, Mr. Joe Public, but seemed sophisticated individuals. Has there been complaints from the public that they feel that they can't get their complaints? I mean, is there a problem, or are we just making a problem when there is not one? Have people complained to the board and said, I wanted to do a complaint and I didn't know how, or my complaints aren't being heard? Or are we just basing it on one or two incidents that have just in the timeline have been not legally sufficient?
I haven't talked to anybody.
Not very long, like a year.
A year.
A year?
Yes. Yeah.
A year?
I haven't talked to any person that was asking about how to do it. So to be really honest with you, if somebody were to call me, I would I would show them this. I would walk them through this, and I would, tell them if you need help, just.
Yeah, and we would too. I mean, if anybody calls the city attorney's office, I mean, of course we can't give legal advice.
Yeah.
But you can absolutely describe. Well, you do it all the time. You can, describe the process and point people to the right place and.
But it doesn't sound like there's been any complaints against the board and anything. I don't follow the media all the time, but I don't think we've made the papers too much. So
negative. When these administrative procedures were adopted in 2012, I mean, like I said, it did add a layer that wasn't in the code, but there was no and the board hashed over these in several public meetings and went through it and have gotten no negative feedback or no no challenge in that regard.
And if we did, just to clarify, if we did want to make changes to the administrative procedures, we could do that as a group, just by vote. Okay. So I'm not proposing any changes.
Yeah.
It's just good to know that we can approve that if
I think just
any one of us feels that is necessary.
I think just a majority.
Yeah?
Yep.
Yep. There's also some things in the administrative procedures that talk about you can meet by telephone, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Can I ask about meeting by telephone? So how does that, do we need to set that up, probably in advance, right? Or
so if you wanted to participate telephonically?
Yeah, because I had the one time where I was out of town for work, and it was how much notice do you need to set that up? I guess
I don't need very much notice at all, because we have a phone right over there.
Oh, okay.
We can hook it right up here. We have an outlet, so we should probably give I think 24 hours notice at least, so that I can let the board know that someone's going to participate. I think where you run into problems is if you have two people that want to participate, so you might want to take a look at.
Or if for some reason nobody's here and we want to conduct the entire meeting by telephone, then we'd have to do something with the meeting notice and stuff like that.
Yeah, that probably won't happen, but it might.
So yes, if you are out of town, not a problem.
Okay, so that was a good start to finish process overview, Martha.
And another thing, you might not know, but you have the authority to issue advisory opinions.
Yeah, we've done that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know, have we?
I think Bill and I, we did one. I got to double check exactly.
Yeah, so that was set up, again, that, if particularly elected officials were concerned or they had, had a preliminary, wanted some input, that they could ask for that. That's in the code, too, but I think we put a process around it that if you receive a request for an opinion, you can meet to decide whether to respond to the request. You don't have to. And if you choose to respond, then you can designate a subcommittee, one or more members, to draft the opinion, and then you present it to the board at the next regularly scheduled meeting or at a special meeting called to go over it.
That probably doesn't happen too often because our code of ethics is very clear and simple for the most part.
Except for where it's Byzantine. Yeah.
I think most of our elected folks kind of know, you know, what they should and should not do, and sometimes people do things inadvertently. I can name a couple cases before I was here that I've read, but
That's actually, are our former decisions available anywhere?
Doris has them.
I have them.
Oh, yeah? Okay. But not, like, online or electronically.
I can put them online, and I need to put them online, and I probably need to get there.
Yeah.
We're just a little bit.
Because they were online before.
Yeah, and then we...
And I think we redid our system, and now they're not.
Yeah. That's
so I think it would be good to...
this new website a while ago, and I just haven't had... We are now fully staffed, so...
Yay for you.
Okay.
Finally. Oh.
Because it would be good to get them online.
Yeah.
Especially for all of us who use for ease of access.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and we are working
on
that.
Any ideas on when you guys might be able to get them up?
So I just started a new person in my office this week. She has 3 days under her belt.
Cool.
So I am looking, like, to get her trained up, and then we're going to come up with a list on priorities on what we need to get sort of caught up on. Board of Ethics is one of them, putting that out. So I would say within the next month.
Good. You know, that would be great.
Do you know how many, like, this? I mean, are we talking about 100 decisions or 10 decisions?
No. I'm thinking 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just scanning them in and getting them up there, just in a nice format, because you just don't want to scan a whole bunch of junk and stick it out there, because then you end up...
Yes.
Yeah.
I know some boards who do that. It's terrible.
It's a hot mess. Yeah.
And this is a relatively new code.
11, I know.
Well, it was 1983, but I think it was pretty skimpy. And then when city had a crisis around something,
we went over it for a long period of time.
Okay. Yeah. The version that we're working from was... updated in 2014.
What was it?
2011, wasn't it? 2011? Gosh.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Times
2011.
But before that, there was something on the books from as far back as 1983, but it wasn't quite like this. The Board of Ethics itself didn't exist at the beginning. It was really a pretty rudimentary, you know, code of ethics for municipal officers, the financial conflicts of interest.
So but guideline.
Pardon me?
Just a guideline, huh?
Well, no, it was in code, but it didn't have all of the procedures and the processes. And what it didn't have was a separate process and a separate body for hearing complaints against... The code defines them as the covered officials, the elected officials, the utilities director, the city manager. Mm-hmm. The process that existed before is it just would have gone through and, you know, been churned through the same process that is now used for
employees.
Standard city employees. Mm-hmm. So this part was new, and then there was an update to it, trying to get some clarification around certain things and adding in the prohibited conduct that talks about remote or ongoing financial interest. So that's continuing financial interest, 1.46030F, which is, you don't have a current financial conflict of interest, but it's basically calling out that if you have had an ongoing financial relationship, say you have worked for a firm or a corporation, or if you're a professional, maybe you're a lawyer or an engineer or something, and your income a substantial amount of your income over the years has come from this particular firm, that could give rise to a conflict. And if you're called upon to administer a contract or award a contract to that particular firm, that would be a conflict, whereas before that, you'd have to actually be working for that firm to have the conflict. So that was something that came about fairly recently.
Yeah, because that may have come up on our last, had it not been a simple resolution. It wasn't a contract. Mm-hmm. In the last case that we had dismissed,
Yeah.
But
but
that's a good discussion of administrative procedures, I think. And it gives us all a little bit of a refresher. And then also some other things.
I'm very appreciative of
this. Oh, sure.
I was going to ask Doris, how far back in time are you going to go with posting cases online, decided cases online?
Let me check and see what I have on file. I'll go back as far as what I have on file. I think when another lady took before I became the staff person. So I'll go back as far as we have.
Okay.
And
that'd
I'll
be
just,
great.
I'll just put them through. And that's the process of, so it's mm-hmm. by year. By
yep.
year, by number.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So is anything of what we do confidential?
The deliberations, if you're actually talking
mm-hmm.
amongst yourselves about, and the emails that are deliberating, but other than that, no.
Yep. So we shut everything down to do our legal deliberations and get legal opinions and that type of thing. And then we make decisions in public. So we have a lot of leeway to be able to discuss,
mm-hmm.
you know, complex cases just mm-hmm. with ourselves. So. And then before we move on, or are there any other points or questions about administrative procedures? So, okay. And I was going to say, too, so other ethics codes and – sorry, go ahead, Bill.
Did you want to suggest we look at something since you brought it up that we can't actually change these administrative procedures? Did you want us to be thinking about contemplating like the vote of only two people out of three – making
that
unanimous or something?
Well, I just thought that was something interesting to bring up. I'm fine with it as it is. So if somebody else had a change that they want to consider, I'm happy to discuss it, but I'm not proposing any changes.
Okay.
So, and then really quickly before we move on to number four, election of officers, other cities and municipalities, and these, you know, Pierce County, City of Seattle, they have different scopes in their ethics codes. And it's good for us to learn more about that. And I think one in particular in Seattle goes much more broadly than I would want to, but I think it would be a point of discussion if we could consider providing a service to the people with elections. Because right now, we don't have any jurisdiction over elections. In the city of Seattle, they probably have a lot more to consider because they are actually very involved in,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas we don't have any jurisdiction over that. And if there was ever a complaint about donations and contracts or any such actions, that would go directly to the PDC.
Right. Well, the city of Tacoma does not have jurisdiction over, we don't run our own municipal elections. So the city, the county auditor's office, so does all of that for us. So that is a difference that Seattle has.
They run their own elections.
They run their own, so they would have reason to be policing those.
And yep.
Is that in the Pierce County ethics then?
Well, Joe's right. If there were allegations of campaign finance issues or,
uh-huh.
you know, that would all go to the PDC. But
okay.
in terms of the conduct of the elections, that would all be under the jurisdiction of Pierce County, so if there was a complaint or a problem.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily want to go into the from that route, but if we could ever do anything to get more information to people, that would be good. But maybe this board is not the appropriate venue to do that. Maybe another board maybe need to be created. But if I have any ideas on that, you know, just think about it and feel free to research Seattle and other entities.
And I haven't looked at it for a while because we just haven't talked, and so we got off base. But I went online and found a whole project that was done at Yale about city codes of ethics and model codes for cities. And it's pretty heavy, but it's full of a lot of information. And I thought it might be something maybe a couple of us might like to sit down and look through together, just to see if there are parts here that we'd like to bring back. Rather than jumping to make a change in this or that, I'd like to spend some time studying what the model code suggests and see if there's something that calls to us. So.
And if, just clarify, so if two of us meet, it's not a public meeting.
Nope.
If we want to meet and brainstorm about an idea, but if three of us get together, then it's a different ballgame. So we can't have any group meetings with three people unless we go through our city staff and attorneys.
Right.
If that makes any sense. So
it's a quorum issue. If you have a quorum as a body.
Right. Yep. Okay, so moving on, I just wanted to very quickly to discuss the election of officers, and that's just the chair and the vice chair, right, Martha?
Yep.
So we are going to be doing that at our next meeting in January, correct?
Yes.
So we have to elect a chair and a vice chair, and Mr. William is not going to be with us at the end of his term, so and we're gonna miss you. So.
Yeah.
Definitely. We like you. But
I've had enough. I want to go retire now. Mm-hmm. Play with my grandkids.
So just think about if anybody wants to serve as chair or as vice chair. I'm happy to continue running the meetings. But if somebody else wants to step into that leadership role, that's perfectly fine with me. We could certainly discuss. So that's going to be coming up at our next meeting. And we're going to nominate officers and elect them. And then we're going to be hopefully fully staffed. Don't we have another, or it's a 5-member board?
Yeah.
So we have another person that we're interviewing.
We're five.
And
yeah, so. Yeah,
so
when I go.
Oh, but you're going for your
right.
Time.
And
you gave me a gentleman's resume, Mr. McCarty.
Name, yeah, James. James McCarty. He's being interviewed by the Government Performance and Finance Committee on November 1st. He did, Katie, when you were interviewed and nominated by the chair, his name was also in there, and they were interested, and they knew that we were going to have another opening. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it to that interview, so he did provide written material to the Government Performance and Finance Committee. They liked what they saw, and so they've asked us to bring him in. So on November 1st, he'll be interviewed, and then depending on what the committee decides at that point, they may nominate him to fill a chair.
Okay.
So this is your last official meeting, is that so?
Well, yeah, this is only October.
Unless we have Paul.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
don't jinx us.
Don't say that.
Okay. Are there any other member comments or topics before we adjourn? And we are adjourned. It is 7:57.